this binary dialogue. Right now we have either you're a climate believer or you're a fossil fuel denier, you know, and there's this war going on. And division is created by fear, and fear is being propagated by some very powerful voices who know they are scaring people and creating fear and therefore creating division. In 25 years, I'd love to see that division go away and we find some humility and we recognize it's not binary, that there are trade-offs here, and we start to work on these things together.
Welcome to Candid Insights. I'm your host, Sahil Badruddin. And today we have with us Dr. Scott Tinker, Director Emeritus of the School of Geosciences at the University of Texas at Austin. Dr. Tinker, it's a pleasure to speak with you.
Sahil, it's good to be here with you. Thanks.
Thank you. Today, I'm hoping we can actually take time to reflect on the nuances of the competing variables when it comes to energy, poverty, and climate change. Those are the kind of areas I kind of want to focus on today.
That sounds great. Those are big ones.
Yeah. As you know, as academics do, and generally, I want to start by defining terms and context for the conversation. In the real world, we have to make trade-offs between climate security, energy poverty, energy security, particularly in the developing world. Energy is necessary for lifting much of the world out of poverty, but climate concerns and environments are also real considerations. I'm hoping to have a constructive and an honest conversation about these trade-offs. So speaking broadly, could you talk about what is the real challenge of the energy transition today, which I know you've defined as an increase in energy while a reduction in emissions, particularly when I see like renewables are only account for an average of 6% of the energy input?
Yeah, I think defining the words are important. So transition, and that is the way I define it, is adding energy because the world still needs more energy. And lowering emissions. Neither one of those said zero emissions or ending poverty. Those are certainly stretch goals, but I think they can almost hinder progress sometimes. And if we can get those working together, and I say and, quite often they're pitched as an or, almost a competitive, are you for energy or for the environment and climate? And in fact, the answer is yes. I am. And we have to do both. Otherwise, both will fail. And we can dive into that if you want to. But I think at a real high level, if the 5 billion people in the world that are living at some level of energy poverty, and that's a big number, don't continue to progress, then climate and emissions reduction doesn't stand much of a chance.
And then I think the challenge also becomes part of the developing world, right? Where China particularly is heavy on coal and India seems to be going into that direction. Again, we have one atmosphere, as you say, is how do we kind of, you know, look at this in a broader way?
Mm-hmm. It's complicated. That's the reality. It's not binary. It doesn't mean it's not solvable. It's not simple, but it is solvable. We got to deal with all those complexities. You outlined a couple there. These two major growing economies that represent almost a third of the world's population combined, and China, who has grown economically sooner than India, about 5x in terms of GDP per person, China to India. India's kind of just getting started, but the same population. So that's a big challenge for Xi Jinping and Narendra Modi. You know, I need to lift my country up. And I know that's going to happen with affordable, reliable energy. On the electricity side, that's coal. And it was for us, by the way, the US and Germany and the UK. And so we can't say, oh, no, no. That's a very available, reliable fuel to them. And therein lies the challenge, is how do you accomplish that economic lift? And they are developing. I think India, I would still call in places emerging, even China definitely developing still strongly. How do you accomplish that and also accelerate them through that economic growth so that they can begin to afford to make other energy choices like we've done, natural gas, nuclear, solar, wind, and other things? And that sounds contradictory or almost ironic, but you have to accelerate through economic development in order to be able to afford to invest in the environmental protections that we all need. The cleanest environments in the world are where it's rich. You just lay it down time after time, clean air, clean water, clean soil, reductions of emissions, at least per capita GDP, have been quite significant in the wealthy world. So this is a great challenge, is again, accelerating through that so that they can afford to do the kinds of investments that we are making.
As you mentioned, the economic security is going to lead the investments into environment. What are some of the positive signs you kind of start to see when that starts happening?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at just macro transitions in fuel, I think when a lot of people think about energy transition, they think we're going away from something and going to switch to something else quickly. So far, globally, we have not done that. We just keep adding wedges. We're using more of every form of energy, including hay, coal, et cetera. When you start to look at some of those macro transitions on a sub-regional basis, you see a reduction in coal in the US and the UK and parts of Europe, replaced by, differently in the US, by natural gas. So hydraulic fracturing or fracking made natural gas very cheap and replaced coal for our power sector and even some other industrial uses in a large way. And so our emissions have come down. It's not a perfect answer, but it's a decrease of significant proportion. In Western Europe, different. They added a big wedge that comprises solar, wind, some biofuels, and other sources like that to replace coal. And they've brought gas, natural gas down as well because they don't have that resource. So you see the kind of the changes in fuel when you can afford to do that. The important part of that dialogue, Sahil, is that optionality matters a lot. In the past, if you go back 60 years, we only had coal, oil, and gas and you know, some wood. Nuclear started coming in the 60s, and we've been adding wedges. So today, globally, we see more energy optionality. Those things still are around in a large way, but we've added hydro and solar and wind, nuclear and biofuels where they matter, et cetera. So those energy options are really powerful. That's another signal that it's succeeding, is optionality. Now, if you start to mandate away options or legislate away or incentivize away those options, you go back to fewer options. And depending on the direction, they can be less reliable than the coal, oil, and gas were. Mm-hmm. And that's not a good answer. So again, find that sweet spot of energy fuel options. And you're seeing that happening in the wealthy world. It's not happening yet in the emerging and developing world because they're just getting started. So that's another signal. And then, of course, all the infrastructure. When you can start to afford to build power lines, big 345 kV in DC and pipelines and shipping lanes and rail lines and trucking and versatility and fuel types for your transportation, this is a sign of success. You can start to measure things like clean water or, you know, clean air, PM 2.5 and clean soils and things. You capture those data and you can see again that where it's heavily regulated, it's good. It's not perfect. They're going to be bad actors and they're going to be lessons along the way, but it's so much better than in the economies where, again, they don't have a strong rule of law. The regulations aren't in place as much. They're still trying to grow and build their economy. So these are signs of success. Reasonably stable, reliable, secure energy and environmental protection. But we can't take it for granted. And we can't pretend like we can go in this direction where we eliminate a bunch of options and all of a sudden that's going to work. Yeah, it won't.
No, agreed. One of the things they say is it's estimated that 80% of the world's population will live in cities by the middle of the century. And a large part of the urbanization is happening in the developing world, the emerging places, as you're mentioning. You know, cities only occupy 3% of the Earth's land, and actually account for 80% of the energy consumption and more than, they say, 70% of the greenhouse gas emissions.
Yeah.
Due to this change of cities in the coming decades, do you see, how can we improve that management of energy so then we can adapt and anticipate, you know, some of the signs you're mentioning? How do we manage better?
If you think about the global population growing towards somewhere around 10 billion people, maybe a little bit more from 8.3 or 4 today, let's say we're going to add 2 billion more people in the next 50 years to the planet. They don't live anywhere yet. They're new. And so the combination of new and migration towards cities gives us a tremendous opportunity to build cities better. Let's just say up to half of the world's cities haven't really been built yet. So you can retrofit, and that has advantages, but you can also construct in a way that is much more designed for energy efficiency, both to save energy and also to have less impact on the environment. That's a good thing. That's a great opportunity for us. Smarter, be smarter, and there are lots of strategies around that. It also, there are positive aspects of cities. We're denser, we stack ourselves tall, and we don't have as much of a land footprint.
Right.
The infrastructure for handling all of our wastes, and humans have plenty of waste, you know, or more efficient, etc. So there are a lot of neat efficiencies that cities provide. The challenge is all of the resources that are required to run a 1 million or 2 million or 5 million person city don't come from the city. They come from somewhere else. Everything that we eat, everything that we wear, everything that we power ourselves with, the electricity that comes in, it's not homegrown there. So you have to be moving it in all the time. Mm-hmm. And that requires access to resources that are much larger than the cityscape itself, aerially. That's a challenge. What does that look like? And I often see studies that kind of make me smile, like this city is green, or this state is green, or this company is green. And that's because everybody else is making all their crap. You know? So when somebody else makes your stuff and sends it to you and you say you're green, well, hold on. You know, there's only one atmosphere. There's only one ocean, set of oceans that are connected. It's all the land, the air. These are all interconnected systems. So we can't play that shell game. We have to kind of give credit on the consumption side of energy more than the production side for the demand side. You know, how do we pay for all that? Well, whoever uses a lot of the energy are responsible for paying for the cleanup of that system. Not those who produce it necessarily. It's easy to want to blame the oil and gas companies. You know, they made all the oil and gas. It's a greenhouse gas producing machine, and let's just blame them. Okay, you know, I could blame a winery for making wine when I drink too much and drive and have a wreck. It's not the winery's fault. I made a choice, and it was a bad one in that example. And I'm not saying energy use is a bad choice, but I am saying it's the demand for that energy. If you want a bigger home, if you want to drive bigger cars, if you want to fly more, wear more clothes and tennis shoes and all the things that, well, it's your responsibility to help cover the cost of that impact. And I think we can proportionally distribute it much better. Cities consume less per capita, but they are large consuming centers, you know, and those are both true statements. So how do you balance that all out so that they can have access to the things they need, everybody who lives in those cities, and still bear their fair share or proportional cost of consumption of all the materials that it takes to do that?
One of the difficult things about some of the new initiatives, and I think some of the challenges of it, has been an increased cost for consumers. So like Europe comes to mind, right? In Germany, which people were like, oh, it's going to be the big poster child for green energy development. It's increasing a new type of poverty, I would say, energy poverty. I know you speak a little bit about this, but like 5 million customers are defaulting on their electric bills, and you have hundreds of thousands of households that are getting cut off from energy because of some of these initiatives. UK has similar issues where you're having more winter deaths due to energy poverty. So the rise in the cost is, you know, I don't think it's such a surprise. But I wonder some of the dire consequences that are faced are actually by the lower income households, particularly in those countries. And that's, I don't feel like that's being discussed. I know people have written about this. This kind of rises up an issue of like a moral case, you know, of energy. Like, how do we tackle poverty, as you're mentioning, while managing energy demands?
Yeah, some of us, and myself included, have been speaking about the regressive impact of the cost of energy, regressive economically. So the least among us economically pay the most proportionally of their income when they have to fill up with the same price gasoline or the same, you know, megawatt or kilowatt hour of electricity. It costs them more proportionally. I think leaders were told something, and they wanted, depending on their political leanings, they wanted to believe it. They were told solar and wind were cheaper, and they also had no emissions. So it was this binary choice. Well, let's do that. Almost too good to be true. Turns out it was too good to be true. But it wasn't fact. It wasn't a lie. Solar and wind are cheaper, but it's at the plant gate where the electron is generated, at the bus bar, if you will. Okay, it's not cheaper to the consumer. And the reason for that is just physics. You hear it all the time, but it matters. The sun isn't always shining at night and cloudy days, and the wind isn't always blowing. And so we in the wealthy world like our electricity always there. We need it always there. So something has to be there to turn on instantly when those things go away, sometimes predictably, sometimes not predictably. That something, whether it's a giant set of batteries, which has its own set of issues, or a load following natural gas plant or some other things, are expensive. It's sitting there redundant. You're doubling your capacity infrastructure in order to keep things reliable. When you double that and it's redundant, it's expensive. So by the time that the cost gets passed down to the consumer, they're paying more. And they're sitting here wondering, wait, I thought it was cheaper. It is there, but And so, okay. And then the regressive piece comes back in. Factories and the folks who have to drive farther to work because they can't afford the flat in London. And those who have to be at work during COVID because they're in a service industry, they can't work from home on their computer in an air-conditioned house and say, oh, COVID isn't so bad. Well, yeah, for a few of us, but not for most of us. So these are the realities that are hitting, and industries are closing in Europe. Companies are leaving. People are getting up in arms with their leadership. So it's incumbent on leaders, all of us, to be honest and truthful about these things and the reality. And you mentioned earlier, I talk about this a lot, there are trade-offs. Solar and wind don't have emissions at the source. That's a good thing. They have environmental impacts when you mine for the metals to make the panels and turbines and the batteries and dump them into landfills. Natural gas has emissions when you burn it. It's a smaller footprint when you produce it, and it's very reliable. As long as Germany doesn't, you don't lose your gas from Russia. And you're Germany, so then our optionality, our portfolio discussion comes back in. You need other options there. So these are the kind of deeper dialogues that are starting to happen, and people are starting to become aware of them for real. And that's a really good thing. So we need to become aware of these deeper dialogues. We understand the energy we eat, food. We start learning about it in first grade. Why aren't we learning about energy, the other energy, in first grade? It affects everything in our lives. But we have these very simple, naive perspectives because that's what a few people are telling us and we don't have access to. And that's my passion, is the deeper dialogues and providing materials and educational things, not telling you what to think, but giving you some things that allow you to think about these topics.
You mentioned solar and wind. And I wanted to talk about some of the trade-offs you're mentioning there. The amount of land it requires, it's affected by weather in different conditions. It maybe requires sometimes more physical footprint than coal and gas. They can also have an impact on the environment itself. They get taken off and, you know, put in places and they're not used after a while. So there's so many things that are happening here that, you know, people are saying this is renewable energy, but then what about some of the when we source them and when we actually get them up? we're not, what about some of those other considerations, right? We all want renewable energy, and I think it'd be great if we lived in a world where all our energy was clean. Some of these nuances, as you mentioned, have to be considered and are often missed. But let's shift it. How do we better meet some of these challenges to increase renewables, yet be caretakers of the environment?
I gave a TEDx talk a few years ago called the Dual Challenge, Energy and the Environment. And 1,100 students live, and in that, at UT actually, and in that I laid out in 18 minutes this discussion about food. You know, I think I used kale and cow as examples of low density and high density energy. They both have challenges. This is a very important concept in energy terms. It's the density, whether it's megajoules per kilogram, that's by weight or by volume, or Vaclav Smil's term, power surface power density, which is the area, energy per unit area, which you have to do for solar and wind because you can't weigh the sun or the wind. And you see just a tremendous density change as you go from dung, batteries is the lowest of all, dung, wood, hay, you know, hay, wood, on up through coal, oil, natural gas, through uranium, thorium, et cetera. They get tremendously denser through time. And what does that mean? It means the bang for the buck. I can get more work done, useful work, from a much lower volume or weight or area of energy collection. And that is good for the environment. High density energy has less environmental impact. That's just the physics of it. So I think the challenge becomes one of conflating climate change and the emissions that drive some of that with solar and wind as a solution. That's the conflation that's happened in our schools, and very impressively, strategically and tactically, by a whole lot of voices. Okay. The downside is it won't work. Solar and wind aren't the answer to climate change. They're a piece, they're a wedge in certain circumstances where it's sunny and windy, or the last mile off grid where people have nothing. I've installed first solar in Gunchukwa in the Arhuaco village in Colombia. That's all they could have. There's no roads or wires or pipelines or nothing. First electricity. So they have a role to play. But ultimately, climate gets addressed by energies that are very dense, that can power the whole world with little or no emissions. And that's nuclear, hydrogen, and even at some level, natural gas, as long as it's replacing coal or something else that's higher emitted. And so it's that new dialogue that is starting to happen. And I think young people particularly are not worried about nuclear energy. They're not scared of that. They low emissions, high density, pretty affordable once it's built, bring it on. And I'm encouraged by that. And again, nuclear can't address everything. If it could, we would just go do that. Everybody would, and it can't. So the portfolios matter, but it's changing this dialogue. And then the important other piece of that is this concept of the word renewable. It sounds great, you know. Hey, it's renewable, but it's not. Mm-hmm. I mine the stuff, again, the metals, to make panels and turbines and batteries, and I manufacture panels and turbines and batteries, and we collect energy, and those things all wear out. So I have to do something with them. I dump them in landfills for the most part and do it again. So a solar field may last 15 to 20 years. Panels wear out. Wind turbine blades, 15 years, maybe 18. Batteries, you know how long batteries last. Mm-hmm. So all these things are having to be replaced over and over. So it's not renewable. It comes from the earth. We make it. We dump it. And by the way, oil and gas is nature's product as well. It comes from the earth. Nature made oil and nature made natural gas. But it's not renewable. We burn it, and we dump that emission into the atmosphere, CO2, or leak methane. So we got to get our heads around this reality and quit using words that sound good but are largely meaningless. And clean is another one of those words. Clean what? Emissions to the atmosphere? All right, I know what we're talking about. Let's address that. Clean water, low land footprint, clean soil, clean local air, which kills 3 million people every year by breathing indoor smoke, 7 million outdoor smoke. That's a lot of people. 7 million people is Norway every year die from breathing particulates. So clean needs to be defined. What is our objective function? And how do you balance those different things to optimize on it? Again, there's trade-offs. There's nothing perfect out there. And that's a very important dialogue to have with all of us so that we can begin to solve these things.
So I want to talk about nuclear energy. I know this is one of the things you mentioned. Nuclear energy to me seems like one of the most viable energy sources that can meet the energy demands of today. But there is a sentiment of negativity and I want to say non-proliferation of nuclear energy for civilian use. Do you believe in a positive proliferation of nuclear energy for civilians while maybe we can remove some of the negative misappropriation of civilian nuclear power or for military purposes? And if so, then how do we kind of put that in place as well?
I do. I think nuclear must be part of the solution globally. Again, it's very dense. Mm-hmm. The bang for the buck is a million times more than coal. So on a per unit weight basis, it's mostly for electricity. When uranium and thorium are the radioactive elements that create a lot of heat. I'm talking about fission now, not fusion. When you split those and that heat boils water, it makes steam, it turns a turbine and it runs a generator. It's a different source of heat than burning coal or natural gas or wood for electricity. But it makes electricity. Electricity has a lot of uses. We're electrifying more things. We will never electrify everything. That's a, again, kind of a neat pitch, but a silly thought. We need molecules. We use molecules for lots of stuff, fertilizers, ammonia, plastics, heat, real extreme heat, you burn molecules. So both of those are needed, but nuclear has a phenomenal role to play in zero emissions from the source, high density, very efficient. And by that, I mean, if the capacity of a nuclear reactor is 10, you're getting electricity from 9.7% of the time. Okay. Or out of 100, 97% of the time. If the capacity of a coal plant is 100, you might get it 60% of the time. The capacity of a wind turbine is 100, you might get it 30% of the time over the whole year. And solar is even lower. So you don't have to build as much stuff to get the same bang for the buck. Mm-hmm. And it's always on. Very, very rare that nuclear reactors go down. So there are a lot of advantages to it, for sure. Proliferation, I was raised to be scared of that. I'm old. So I grew up in the Cold War. And there was a worry that if you had nuclear power, you would then take those spent fuels and the plutonium component of that and enrich it to weapons grade. And that's possible, but it's a lot of physics that has to happen to come to a weapons grade product out of nuclear power plants. It's not just a plug and play. That said, it's doable, and we have to continue to maintain our strong international nuclear treaties and laws and rules around that. And it's scary. It's real. Nuclear weapons are a scary thing. Nuclear electricity is not, to me. I would be most happy to have a small modular reactor sitting right out that window, generating 50 megawatts and powering this whole 100,000 person area, or whatever. It'd be great. Those are the differences, I think, that we got to separate weapons and electricity.
Agreed.
So the leading nuclear countries today are Russia and China. Mm. They're building 75% of the world's nuclear power plants today. Again, China's being forward-looking and thinking well out in advance. I'd say the U.S., which led in the 60s and 70s, behind. We've got to catch up, but we're starting to see that happening in our nuclear engineering programs across the U.S. Kids are starting to enroll in them again and see that future. And then there's the uranium that's needed. It depends on what generation you have, the different fuels that are needed, and the cooling strategies for that. light water cooling reactors, sodium cooling, which is TerraPower small modular strategy, et cetera. I think they all are making good advances, but you've got to have fuel. And we used to mine our own uranium oxides here up until Three Mile Island, and then that died, and we continue to import the uranium dependent on others. It's not that we don't have it, but we have to be willing to go get it again. And then there's fusion, a whole different strategy. It's not splitting the atom, it's fusing them together to create heat. And that has made great advances in the last few years. It's been making slow advances, but some real big advances. And it's inherently very different. It doesn't have the same challenges of waste that fission does. It is kind of the holy grail out there, if you will. You get fusion working and commercialized, there's a lot of good that happens from that. Mm-hmm. So I'm hopeful and have visited with people that are working on those things. And hopefully my kids and my grandkids will have access to that kind of truly clean, very efficient, affordable electricity, and then do other things with it.
Mm-hmm. In addition to uranium, I wanted to talk about thorium. There's actually been a lot of research being done on thorium for nuclear energy. I'm not sure if, I don't know how much you've looked into it, but can you speak about thorium and then maybe other alternative methods as well that the public might not be aware of?
Sure. Yeah, some. Again, not my area, but I mean, thorium is a different radioactive element. Mm-hmm. It has some advantages over uranium. We, ironically, as I understand it, there's less plutonium that comes from the fission products of thorium.
Correct.
Than from uranium. And you'd say, well, that's a good thing. Well, let's use thorium. And we should. But when we were building our reactors, we actually wanted the plutonium because we were in an arms race with Russia. So we built uranium reactors, as did Russia. And so there was a war component to that strategy. Thorium would be a great radioactive element for heat and, again, generation of electricity. It's located differently. Its compounds are different and what it's locked up in, and mineralogically. So it would spread the source rock optionality out, which would be good. I think, again, both options would be nice on the fission side because it's always good to have options in case supply chains get strained, et cetera. But in general, a very good option and somewhat better in terms of the fission products. We in this country don't do much with our spent fuel. We keep it in dry cask and swimming pools and the fuel rods and swimming pools at the nuclear power plant sites.
Mm.
We pay to have it put away geologically. We're taxed, but we haven't ever used those taxes for that. So we need to, I think. We need to start thinking about how to spend that money to continue to grow the nuclear program. And we had an option going in Nevada. Yucca Mountain dug a big hole, spent billions of dollars, and then it was killed when one of the senators there was in a pretty tight race and didn't want to lose it because his constituency didn't want spent fuel being trucked across the country and put in Yucca Mountain. So there you have it. France, on the other hand, recycles and reprocesses that spent fuel. We filmed that in our first film. It's called the La Hague Recycling Facility. It's out on the Normandy coast in a beautiful area. And we take you inside and show what they're doing to reprocess and recycle and reuse the spent fuel, so you get another whole round of heat out of it. And the volume goes down, the heat goes down, there's a lot of good, but it costs money. So there, again, the trade-offs.
Mm-hmm. One of the other things that's emerging is geothermal. Mm-hmm. Now, as a geologist, what are your thoughts on geothermal? And what about work being done to marry fracking into geothermal?
Sure. Sure. Well, there's two big strategies for geothermal. One is used today, and it's the shallow geothermal for homes and businesses where you capture water that's 50 to 100, 150 feet deep. And with your heat pump strategy, you circulate water, 50-degree water, 60-degree water through a home. Well, in really cold days in the winter, that warms the home and you add a little bit. And in hot days in the summer, that cools the home and you add a little bit. So it's pretty neat for that. Now, it's still a little bit more expensive than paying for electricity off of a grid, et cetera. So it isn't done as much, but it will be, it can be. And it's a nice off-grid solution as well. The other big one that you're talking about is using the heat, the thermal gradient of water to create electricity. So the most prolific are places like Iceland, where the heat of the earth is right at the surface. And there's geologic reasons for that, which I won't go into because, you know, you don't want to kill your listeners. But let's just say the heat of the earth is right there at the surface. You literally drill a shallow well and steam comes out of it. The same steam you would get by boiling water with coal or gas or nuclear. And they put that steam through a power plant, turn a turbine, run a generator, very clean. Now they have to manage the geothermal fields. You still have to drill wells and move wells. It's a resource. That's the best stuff. The more realistic stuff, the broader reach is where you, as you go down in the earth, it gets hotter. It's like getting under a bunch of blankets, okay? Mm-hmm. So the earth is a nice blanket, and the water, all the little pores in the earth, many people may not know this, are filled with old oceans. Okay, all the sandstones, and they're filled with old oceans from ancient times, hundreds of millions of years ago. That nasty old ocean water had been sitting down there for hundreds of millions of years, filling the pores. It's hot. It's hot water. So if I drill a deep well or go into an old well that's been drilled and repurpose it, I can get enough thermal gradient from the bottom of that, let's say, 30,000 foot well, 6 miles deep in the earth, to create electricity. And it works. There's no technological challenge here. There was, but it does work. It can be more expensive than the other things we have. The thing you're talking about, where you go down and you crack really hot rock that may not be full of water or not have much. So you crack the rock and you pump water into that system where it heats up. And then I produce that hot water and I've got my geothermal gradient. So that's taking existing oil field technology and doing what you need to do in the subsurface to crack the rock and make the hot water. There's a lot of ways to go about this. And I might mention one other thing back to nuclear. I advise a company called Deep Isolation, and they're looking at these oil wells, large diameter well bores for nuclear waste storage. So rather than digging out Yucca Mountain, the giant hole, put it down a well bore. In special patented canisters, put it down into the well bore a few miles into the earth and keep it there. So this is not a bad strategy either for handling the nuclear waste, because there's pretty low volumes of it. It's just quite intense. So yeah, geothermal has some upsides. I think it will be part of those portfolios. It's not a very big part today. Again, mostly on a cost basis, Sahil. It can't compete yet cost-wise, but it's getting closer.
And then one thing we didn't talk about was carbon sequestration. Why would companies, you know, want to stop emitting CO2 if it's not profitable to capture it? And then what about creating a market demand for carbon as a way to economically incentivize decarbonization, ironically?
We've been at the Bureau. I started a carbon capture and sequestration or storage group now called 25 years ago. So we've been at this a long time. The concept simply is capture the CO2 from the stack where you're burning coal or gas or oil, either post-combustion or in some cases pre-combustion chemically, capture it before it goes into the atmosphere, compress it into a supercritical phase. So that's pressure and temperature. You get it into a phase that behaves like a liquid. And then you move it in pipelines, and then you inject it in well bores back into the rocks, into those old oceans we just talked about. Mm. So think about your soda pop. It's carbonated. What when you crack that soda pop, bubbles up. Those bubbles are CO2. Okay, we drink away. And it, we're talking about less than 1% concentration to do this at scale. It's technologically doable. There have been some great federal government investments and corporate investments to show that technology works. We get back to the cost, the things I just described: capture, compression, moving, injecting, monitoring it. There's costs all along the way, and that's not cheap. So why would companies do it? It's a cost to them. They do it because the federal government gives them money to do that through various tax incentives in order to lower emissions and address climate change. That's the motivation for pure brine storage or saltwater storage. We can use CO2 for other things, and we do. Food uses, I just talked about. There's CO2 to molecule studies going on. How do you use CO2 in other ways that's advantageous? And then it's used for enhanced oil recovery. When you put CO2 down into oil reservoirs, it changes the way the oil and the rock interact. I'll just leave it at that. It's called wettability. It releases more oil. And it turns out it stores CO2. So we've done a bunch of work that shows that's actually a net storage process, and you produce more oil, which is energy. And then you capture that CO2 and put it back, and you end up storing more CO2 than you produced, and you get some energy along the way. That's not a bad use. The challenge with all that is the scale of the issue is way bigger than these profitable use strategies. They can supplement that. EOR, enhanced oil recovery, food uses, CO2 to molecules are all good supplements. But we still have to store more than that if we're really going to do meaningful reduction in carbon emissions. So you partner all those things together. And when I say government investment, that's a taxpayer. We all pay for that. Goes right back to the regressive conversations. Who pays the most proportionally? Da, 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 da. Is it a greater good? Is it a public need? Compare it to other things. You know, contrary to what some of us seem to believe, we don't have an endless supply of money. It's not renewable. So you have to make choices, and people are making investment choices. And that's what your vote does. It allows you to vote for people who are making the kinds of investment choices that you think are important. And people have different opinions about that. So I like CCS for some things. I know some people don't, but I think it's a wedge. It's one of those wedges that will help reduce some emissions and allow us to continue to produce energy and make it less climate intensive.
I often ask my guests about a vision that they have for the future. You've spoken a lot about challenges of global energy and global poverty and things as such. Could you name a specific objective perhaps you could see the world achieve in, let's say, 25 years? And what insights and suggestions would you offer that would, you know, help us address and achieve this vision within the time frame?
Well, my hope and my vision is that we can end the division between this binary dialogue. Right now we have either you're a climate believer or you're a fossil fuel denier, you know, and there's this war going on, this apparent war. You can't
ideological.
Be both. Yeah, exactly. And division is created by fear, and fear is being propagated by some very powerful voices who know they are scaring people and creating fear and therefore creating division. In 25 years, I'd love to see that division go away. And instead, we cancel canceling and we find some humility and we recognize it's not binary, that there are trade-offs here, and we start to work on these things together so that solar and wind would be working with natural gas, and natural gas is the reliable source of fuel to make electricity, and solar and wind have lower emissions at the source, but aren't as reliable, and they partner together. We know they do this physically, and they work together, and they create partnerships, not warring factions. Okay, so we get rid of the fear and the scaremongering, and instead we create a very powerful, positive movement forward, particularly with young people who are working on solutions here. And in doing that, the major benefit will be you will increase human flourishing. you will see an acceleration out of poverty, out of emerging economies will become developing, and developing will become developed. We will accelerate economic growth, providing more capital to invest in the environment. It's virtuous. And in 25 years, that's your time frame you suggested, that's doable. I'll be a really old dude or gone, but I have a lot of faith and trust that the work we're all doing now will get us there. But we've got to recognize that the voices that are promoting fear are not promoting solutions. They are not promoting, they're trying to negotiate with physics, Sahil, and you can't negotiate with physics. And it's tough to negotiate with economics too. So let's get on the pages of energy reality and move that dialogue forward so that we can accomplish multiple things. Not perfectly, no perfect solution here, but effectively. All right. And that's my hope. And I think it's possible.
Yeah. Dr. Tinker, this has been insightful. Thank you so much.
I'm glad to have been with you. And thanks for what you're doing to continue to bring thoughtful conversations to the public.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to today's episode with Canada Insights. If you enjoyed it, don't forget to subscribe or follow us on social media for updates on future episodes. If you've already subscribed, please leave us a rating or review. It does help new people find the podcast. I'm Sahil Badruddin, your host, and for a transcript of this interview and others, visit my website at sahilbadruddin.com.